Good evening. I'm Kitty Goddard, president of AIR, Arts Incubator of Richardson, and I wanted to welcome you to this very special presentation as we kick off season 6 of Airtime. And not only is it season 6, which is quite monumental considering some of our humble beginnings, but it is also the beginning of our 3rd year in a partnership with Alamo Drafthouse. And we are thrilled with their support of AIR, and please give Alamo Drafthouse a round of applause. Airtime is a signature artist interview series featuring artists and creative thinkers in Richardson and the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where artists share about their art and why their creativity makes a difference. Not only is this the kickoff to season 6, but tonight we are also celebrating a wonderful new partnership with Richardson Reads One Book Program. And Susan Allison and Janet Vance, who are the leaders and directors of that program, are here. Would you all please wave or stand wherever you are? They're over here. Please give them a round of applause. The focus of Richardson Reads One Book is to encourage an entire community to read a selection and then come together to discuss it, share ideas, and experience a presentation by the author. This year's selection is We Are Called to Rise by author Laura McBride. The book focuses on multiple themes that readers will be interested in, including multicultural differences and values, PTSD, and the casinos of Las Vegas, hence the movie selection of Ocean's 11. The presentation by the author is next Tuesday, September 15th at 7:30 at Richardson High School. Tickets are free, but it is a ticketed event. And there are some tickets back here on this median row here that if you wish to take one when you leave, please do so. They would love for you to share in the author's presentation on Tuesday. Also, Half Price Books is in the lobby selling the book, and they wanted you to be sure and know they will be here until 8 o'clock. So if you haven't read the book and would like to get a copy for yourself, they are in the lobby. Thank you again to Richardson Reads One Book for reaching out to us and for their leadership in this program. This is a little longer than our usual introduction, but I have to take a moment to introduce the newest member of our Airtime team, our new moderator, Mr. David Fisher. And for those of you who have been to multiple Airtimes and are wondering, what happened to Chris? Well, we didn't run him off. He moved out of town because he felt it was more important to live with his wife. Go figure. But anyway, his departure is also a wonderful bit of good luck for us. David was one of our guest artists for Airtime about 3 years ago. So now we're telling all of our guest artists that beware, you might become our moderator. Anyway, David is currently the interim director for the City of Dallas Office of Cultural Affairs, where he has worked since 1995. In his tenure there, he has managed the Bathhouse Cultural Center, the Meyerson Symphony Center, WRR Radio, and other programs. In 2011, he took 2 years away from the office to serve as executive director for the Turtle Creek Corral. He has an MFA in directing from Tulane University and an MBA in nonprofit management from the University of Dallas. I think he's qualified. Tonight will be the litmus test, maybe. No pressure. In addition to being involved in the arts, he is a soap maker and creates candles. And he writes a blog about candle and soap making on about.com. Now, to Airtime. It's September the 9th, 2015, and today's guest creative thinker is the one and only Chief Operating Officer and owner of Alamo Drafthouse Cinema DFW, as well as former Green Beret and recipient of 2 bronze medals, Mr. Bill DiGaetano. Please... please give a warm welcome to Bill and our moderator, David Fisher.
Thank you, Kitty. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be a part of Airtime. I was actually a guest of Airtime a few years ago when I was with the Turtle Creek Corral, and I went back and listened to that podcast. It was fun to remember that in that interview, I said that I owed a great debt to the city of Richardson, and that one of the great turning points of my career as an arts administrator was when I was appointed the interim director of the Meyerson Symphony Center after its previous manager, Bruce McPherson, went to be the founding manager of the Eisman Center here in Richardson. person. So while my career is and focus right now is particularly Dallas-centric, I'm grateful and thrilled to be here and continue my great ties with the city of Richardson and to be a part of any effort to promote local artists and to be a part of our entire cultural community. I'm also really excited to welcome and get to know a little better our guest for today, although I guess I should perhaps say our host as well as our guest, Mr. Bill DiGaetano, who is the owner and chief operating officer of the Alamo Draft House. So when I was doing some research on Alamo, it is not referred to as a movie theater. It is referred to as a lifestyle entertainment brand that was recently named the best theater in America by Entertainment Weekly. And in 2014, the Alamo Draft House Richardson was awarded Dallas Observer's Best Movie Theater and D Magazine Reader's Choice for Best Movie Theater in DFW. So I know we have a lot to talk about. We have the book, we have PTSD and Las Vegas and war and children and multiculturalism, but I actually want to talk about movies a little bit first. We just barely touched your bio, and the other half of your bio really touches into the themes of this book that we're working to with the Richardson Reads One Book program. So I was recently in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian Institute, and I saw one of the original silver foil TV dinner trays. They had a display of sort of 1950s TV, and there was information about how TV dinners changed not only how we ate dinner, but how we consumed television. And it made me think about how movie theaters have evolved over the past several years. So tell me a little bit about Alamo. What is it about Alamo that attracted you? Why do you think it works so well? And why is this indeed the best movie theater in DFW?
Well, thank you all for being here and putting up for this hour and a half to 2 hour long discussion before the movie. It's not that bad. It's 3 hours? Okay. The best way I can say what differentiates Alamo from other theaters is that we truly are a brand that is run by movie lovers for movie lovers. So from our founder, Tim League in Austin, to myself, who owns the DFW locations, our managers, our staff, and our people, we are a passionate group of people, and we hire for passion. In fact, if you were our guest here during our first few months open, you experienced how great passion can be and how terrible it is when you don't hire experienced servers. But they get their legs under them quickly, and then you have these people that are passionate about film, passionate about craft beer, passionate about food. So I think that's truly what separates us, is it is just a brand of movie nerds, of beer nerds, of foodies that converge together and have a good time.
Sure.
Thank you. In the cheap seats.
Well, and I was on the website and then just it was experiencing in the lobby the notion of we all live our own individual lives. And I think if I was trying to compare the experience of the people I saw in the lobby here today with other movie experiences, I think you go to other movie places and you go to the kiosk and you use your credit card. I mean, nowadays you don't even have to see a person at the window and say two for, you just put your credit card in and you're anonymous and you go in and you have your experience and then you leave, whereas there were people interacting in the lobby and people who seemed to recognize each other, and that notion of this being a cultural center, a community gathering place, while centered around film, it really was as much about community as it was about the film. So tell me about how you feel about that, how it works, and how you see this model going into the other communities, Little Elm and Las Colinas and the Cedars.
We always very much try to be a neighborhood theater. And so with us being a franchise, you do have owners in the market, which is important. You know, we take a lot of pride in what we do. But it's just that hands-on approach. And, you know, we don't call our ticket booth a ticket booth. We call it a concierge. They're there to help, to talk about movies and also to move the line if there is one. You know, we do know our regulars. We encourage our managers to know their names, to reach out to them. In fact, we have a loyalty program called Victory, which there may be members in here. Awesome. Tonight there's a Victory screening, which is completely at no charge for certain Victory members of Close Encounters in the theater over there. We get to know these people, and our top brass are people that come here a lot. Is it over 50 times a year? And we have a lot of those individuals. I mean, that is no small group of people. So it's we've tried to create a culture of all-inclusiveness. You know, we try to get people assimilated to the Alamo way as quickly as possible because it is a lot different than other theaters. We do have strict no talking, no texting policies. We do have 32 beers on the wall. Those change very frequently. So thank you guys. And so it's just that, I think, top-down approach of we want our staff to not be, you know, a face. We want to know them. We want them to be happy. We want that to come down to our guests. And I think that's what you saw in the lobby tonight.
I would agree. And coming from cultural affairs and running cultural centers that do film and live performance, I would say that's very much the experience everywhere. So let's move on to the next half of your bio. You received a Bachelor of Business Administration from St. Edward's in Austin. And after receiving that degree, worked for several years developing new business for marketing firms. And then in 2005, you enlisted in the United States Army. After 2 years of training, you became a member of the Army Special Forces, better known as the Green Berets. During your time in the military, you were deployed twice to Afghanistan in support of Operation Enduring Freedom, as well as a four-month stint in Colombia, South America. So, business guy, marketing guy, takes a detour and enlists in the Army. What were you thinking? I don't mean that in a sarcastic way. I mean, what is the path that took you there?
Yeah. An untraditional one, to say the least. The military had always been in my mind, and I don't come from a military family. My father was not in the military. Both grandfathers were in World War II. My dad's dad was infantry in the Pacific, and then my mom's dad was Coastie for 20 years. So there was that aspect of it, but I did not come from a military family, but always had the urge to serve, and more so than that, challenge myself mentally, physically. So I did get a bachelor's degree at St. Ed's, was working for almost 5 years and doing very well in outside sales. And it was just that nagging feeling. And I didn't want to go through life saying, I wish I would have done it. I wish I would have tried it. I almost enlisted on the day after 9/11 and didn't for personal family reasons. And we had a family member sick, so that kind of, you know, I wanted to stay close to home. So it was... This sounds terrible. I had a condo in downtown Austin. I was doing very well in outside sales, and I was on our rooftop deck, and a Black Hawk helicopter went over, and I said, this is crazy. And I went to Dobie Mall in Austin where the recruiters were and did not take my commission as an officer, even though I could have gone that route. Enlisted in the 18 X-ray program, which was a certain program for certain individuals off the street to come try their hand as a special forces soldier. Basic training at beautiful Fort Benning, Georgia, in the summer. Infantry training was there, airborne training was there, and then we headed to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where I spent a lovely 3 weeks in our selection course. We have a very healthy rivalry with other special operators, SEALs being one of them, and we always say they do Hell Week, and we do Hell 3 weeks. I got through selection somewhat unscathed and then proceeded on to another 2 years of training before I got to my team. So that's kind of how I got to that point. And I went in late. I was 25 years old when I joined the military, but the unit is a very mature unit. The average age is about 32. So I was actually a younger guy when I got to the unit, even though I was a very old guy in basic training. So that was kind of the pathway. It was just really a selfish decision, I suppose, because I didn't want to have regrets later on and did not.
What a great story. I think it's your military service and your relationship to Alamo and that sort of ties into the book. So the book is called We Are Called to Rise, a new novel by first-time author Laura McBride that weaves four storylines together and touches on themes of home, family, war, childhood, service, and forgiveness. Two of the lead characters served in Iraq. It's set in Las Vegas. I have not been to Fort Benning, but Las Vegas is a truly unique city, sort of on one hand hot and oppressive and barren, and yet on the other hand full of life and excitement and intrigue. The book includes characters from different generations and national backgrounds who, I suppose, like anyone that is having a human existence, is finding their way. So one of the characters, who is a social worker, actually a CASA volunteer working with children in troubled situations, she says something early in the book that struck me. I want to read a passage. It's a character named Roberta. She says, "We send our children off knowing they will grow up, thinking the military will give them security, hoping they won't be hurt, praying they won't die, believing that ours is a patriotic choice. And our children come back with that war deep within them. A war fought with powerful weapons and homemade ones. A war fought by trained fighters and 12-year-old boys. A war fought to preserve democracy, to extract revenge, to safeguard oil, to establish dominance, to change the world, keep the world exactly the same. Yes, Vegas's children fight America's wars. These most American, least American of children, these children of the nation's brightest hidden city, the city that is an embarrassing tick, a secret shame, a giddy relief, a knowing wink. But then, fighting a war, going to college, working at Caesar's Palace, these are choices for children who grow up. In my line of work, I worry most about the ones who might not. So it struck me that how do you think that what she's talking about there is how war changes us. Mm-hmm. How does war, and you've seen it firsthand, how does seeing and participating in a war firsthand change you for either the better or the worse?
So I'll touch on a few things. One, I am not a millennial. I think I missed it by 1 year. But there's a lot of people that give the millennial generation a hard time, and this comes to the volunteer portion of that segment. We just finished fighting the longest war in this nation's history, the War on Terror. It was a 100% volunteer military, and the majority of that military were millennials. So I always take offense when people say millennials are a lazy bunch, because that's not what I experience in the military. It's not what I experience here. So it was 100% volunteer military. And some people did it for college. Some people did it because they had no other options, but it was a choice. And it does change you for better or worse, as every life experience changes you. There was a statistic when I was in the military that 10% of the Army is ground warfare, actually combat arms. And of that 10%, only 1% saw combat. This was spouted off to me by drill sergeants, so we have no idea where this came from or if it was real. But it seemed real because it's what we experienced. And I was a part of that 1%. It was a very good unit, great men. There were 12 of us, and we ran missions behind enemy territory, within enemy territory. I was one of my two team snipers. So, I mean, we experienced it all firsthand. And it is an experience that changes you. There's no way it can't. But there's always this thought that people were forced into this or they didn't have any choice. And that was not my military experience, and this was just my own. It was a very elite group of triple volunteers. They volunteered for the military, they volunteered for airborne school, and then they volunteered for special forces. So I didn't see that aspect of the military. But again, this was my experience. And it was a good experience. It was an experience full of trials and tribulations. You know, you lose friends, you lose colleagues, and you run some very interesting missions. But I walked away from it very fulfilled and very much liking what I did. I almost stayed in, but 1 month before leaving on my last tour of duty, my wife informed me that we were pregnant with our first child. And so that's when I said, all right, it's time to throw in the towel. So deployed for almost 9 months with my first child on the way, which is a sobering thought for a 28-year-old young man. And, you know, you re-sign your will before you go out on every mission. You leave letters and videos for the kiddo in case you don't come back. So those kind of things, I think, stay with some people and they don't. But it's all a product of the experience in the military, the mindset of that person, and the experience they had prior in life.
Now, we were talking before we started the live part of the interview about how it's been said that 30 years ago, 50% of us would have had a friend or family member who was in the military or served in the military. But now the statistic is like 4% of the population actually knows someone or has a family member in the military. So I think that changes us as civilians. I think it changes our perspective of war, and it changes our perspective of soldiers, of military personnel, and the compassion and the effect that war has on people. I mean, I think we saw that some in Vietnam, and we've certainly seen that with the Gulf Wars and the recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Do you think that war has changed, or are we just more insulated from it? How has our perspective changed on war and military personnel?
I think it's the opposite. I don't think the country's insulated from it at all. I mean, the media is everywhere at once, and the statistic from 50 years ago is obviously a product of the draft and the fact that the entire country was part of the war effort. I mean, my grandma was Rosie the Riveter. I mean, she was literally a riveter in the shipyards in Philadelphia while my grandfather was away in the Pacific. So I think that statistic has changed because war has changed. We have not gone through a draft with the current war on terror. I don't think we're insulated at all. I mean, if anything, I mean, you can turn on the news every day and see what's going on. And in one respect, I mean, for example, the crisis going on in Syria right now and the outrage of that drowned little boy is a very good thing. It draws world attention to it. But the problem with the country at large, and I'm as at fault as any of us, is a short attention span. Wars are easy to win. For this country, wars are extremely easy to win if you let soldiers do what we need to do and keep the media off our backs. Taking a country over, thank you, and putting together a government, civil services, and those aspects of actually turning a country around are hard. Look at World War II. We still have bases in Italy. We still have bases in Japan. We still have bases in Germany. You can't exit a war zone and expect everything to be hunky-dory. You have to spend the money, you have to spend the lives and the commitment to get it done. And I think that's the problem with how non-insulated the country has become is, you know, after 9/11, I mean, I think everybody in this room probably remembers the outpouring of patriotism, but we lose that stomach very fast. And in my experience, again, war is easy. The after effects are what's hard. And we're seeing that both the current crisis with ISIS in Iraq, we're seeing it with the crisis at home with a lot of veterans with post-traumatic syndrome. I refuse to use the term disorder, as many vets do. And you have to spend the money to get it done on both those fronts, or else what is it for? And as a soldier, we're not politicians. It's never been our place to say what we do or don't do. And whenever someone bashes the military, which rarely happens in my presence, but it has happened, I always say that, you know, in the day and age we live in, regardless of the conflict, whether we agree with it or don't, and I will say there were parts of that conflict that I didn't agree with, without a standing military, the country doesn't exist. So at least support the soldiers, the airmen, the Marines, God help them, and the Coasties and everybody else. Just professional rivalry for the devil dogs in the audience. So that's kind of my perspective on that. I will say, you know, and we saw this with the first Gulf War, the outpouring of people supporting the veterans when they came home because of what we saw in Vietnam. And I think we have felt that. I have felt that as a veteran. I have felt that coming into airports, coming home. We did not travel in military uniforms, and I had a ponytail and a six-month growth of beard. So nobody knew we were in the military, but there were other soldiers in that airport and they were getting applause and it was good and it felt good. So I think it's a catch-22. I think the media, as I said, with the Syrian tragedy that is going on right now, it's a very good thing to draw attention to that. But it also makes our jobs much harder. The first time I was in Afghanistan versus the second time, the rules of engagement changed. And that's good to an extent. It is good. You don't want to take on the characteristics of an enemy, but you also have to fight an enemy that does not care about political correctness. They do not care about standards or anything else. So at times you have to unleash those dogs of war in a somewhat politically correct way. So the media made it tough on us. I actually personally had a 60 Minutes crew follow us for the first 4 months of my deployment in Afghanistan. And that was a rough 4 months. I mean, they slowed us down significantly and almost got us killed a few times, but they got some good footage and life went on. So
that's a great perspective. Thank you for sharing that. It certainly gives a different perspective to that notion of winning the battle versus winning the war. The notion that we still have World War II bases and still are tidying up those issues. So to wrap it up, I want to go back to the book. The book has four simultaneous plot lines that sort of weave together and all sort of hinge on one turning point moment. And I won't reveal that turning point moment. It's really a lovely, amazing, moving book. But I've always been fascinated by those moments in time where we are in just the right place at just the right time with just the right person, and just by kismet or fate or chance or luck or whatever, we say what we need to say, meet who we need to meet, fall where we need to fall, miss a bus where we need to miss a bus. So to wrap us up, do you have one of those moments you'd like to share, whether it be in the military or personally or in Alamo or anything like that?
It's kind of a serious, but it's also, there's a funny side of the story. This was our second tour in Afghanistan, and my ODA, that's an Operation Detachment Alpha, was basically a SWAT team for the southern half of the country. So it was a very good mission set in that we weren't on the roads. We were taking helicopters wherever we needed to go. And staying off the roads is half the battle. At least it was in 09. We were always going to get very high profile targets, and we had interpreters with us, obviously. And our interpreters had ways to listen in on the enemy's rudimentary communication system and would talk to us about things. So we're on a mission, and as I said, I was a sniper, so my job was to get to the roof and protect the guys as they were going door to door, which is interesting because you have to actually clear buildings to get to the roof, which is difficult with a large weapon like that. So we're on the roof, and my interpreter, who named himself, is Lucky. Lucky, in his namesake, was a young kid. This kid was 16 years old, but spoke fluent English and had the job and was vetted through the Department of Defense and the CIA and had a top secret security clearance. So he was our interpreter, this kid. And so we're up there, and the mission is getting interesting. We were supposed to be there 3 hours in and out, and we were now working on 18 hours, and it was broad daylight. The beautiful thing about special operations helicopter units is they're very good at flying in the dark. They don't like flying during the day. So we were biding our time until night came again, and usually that's when a counterattack comes. So we started receiving effective fire, which is, we got shot at most missions. It's just, it happened. But when you hear pops and whizzes, that's when you know it's close. It's breaking the sound barrier near your ears, and that's when it's time to get worried. So we started taking effective fire from an enemy machine gun and a sniper. And so I was on the roof looking for the sniper, and he was either 100 meters from me or 1,200 meters from me, which tells you two things about a sniper. Either they're very good at hiding or they're very good at shooting. There was an Afghani, because we worked with locals, a machine gunner next to me, and he took a round to the throat and died instantly. So I got him, you checked him, got him off the roof to the medic. Well, that shot probably happened from 1,000 meters away. I mean, that's 3,000 feet. So, I mean, had that sniper exhaled at a different time or inhaled at a different time or had the wind shifted, that bullet could have very well come for me. And that kind of snaps through your head instantly. And it is, there are those moments that happen. And it happens a lot in combat. It happens a lot in life. I was running the other day and I was on a sidewalk and a car pulled out. And had I picked my pace up, just a little bit, it would have hit me. But that's life and we get through it. So that's the serious part of the story. The funny part of the story comes back to good old Lucky. So Lucky was telling me all day what the enemy was saying, and they're talking about their wives, they're talking about mundane things. I mean, most of these enemy soldiers are not fanatics, they are poor farmers that have no cash crops because we're burning the marijuana and opium because it funds terrorism, but it also prevents terrorism, thus the gray area of war. So they're not fanatics, they're just talking about mundane everyday things, and Lucky is telling me all of it. I'm Lucky. Just pertinent military things. That's all I need to know. I mean, he's talking my ear off. He's a young kid. He's very excitable. And, all day I'm up there and it's me and my spotter. And, my spotter's name was Smitty. He finally went away. He's like, I can't deal with this anymore. So this is after the machine gunner. Lucky has been silent for hours. And you hear chatter on the radio. You can hear them talking. And he says, Bill, I think we should get off the roof. And I said, why, Lucky? And he said, well, they have mortars and rocket-propelled grenades, and they're going to start engaging the building starting at the top and working their way down, and I think they're going to start with this one. And I said, how do you know that? And he said, well, they describe what you're wearing perfectly. And the radio had been silent. I mean, silent for 30 minutes or more, I mean, I had not heard a word. I was like, Lucky, this is the pertinent information that I was telling you about. Mortars started coming in, and mortars are very scary because all you hear is a whistle and then booms. And so we're throwing them off the building and jumping off, and all hell breaks loose. And the Air Force came in and saved the day because there were only 12 of us. And that was I guess that's funny to a soldier. It was kind of I don't know. It's funny now that you're looking back, but it was just, that was Lucky. And it's just this very young kid who does happen to be in the States now. We still keep in touch. And so it's, again, those moments in time. Had Lucky decided to stay quiet, you may not be here. But that's not just combat. That's everywhere. We all experience that every day. And the book does a very good job of talking about that. And it's actually loosely based on actual events that happened in Nevada, which is interesting.
So we have a few minutes to open it up to the audience. Where the question was Bill's difference between calling post-traumatic stress disorder versus post-traumatic syndrome. And how he prefers not to call it a disorder, but rather just a syndrome.
That's been my experience. I think it's just because it is this mantra of very tough guys and very capable girls and very A personality types don't like the disorder attached to it. And I don't get me wrong, there are soldiers that land at a very large airbase, never leave the airbase and come home. But during that time, they may have been in mortar attacks and things like that. everyone comes home with some type of post-traumatic stress. I mean, if you've been in a near accident, you've had a post-traumatic stress situation, and there are after effects. But it's all dealt with differently with everyone. You know, somebody actually asked me recently if I ever dealt with it, and had you asked me that right when I got back from Afghanistan, which was to a 9-month pregnant wife, we had just got done running 5 missions trying to get some Afghani soldiers that were kidnapped off the base. Very intense missions. Stopped the missions. We couldn't find them. My colonel says, "Digitano, your wife's due in a week." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Get on the plane." And so I literally had just got done running combat missions, got on a plane, and 20 hours later, I'm coming into Bergstrom in Austin, and there's my 9-month pregnant wife who I haven't seen in 9 months. And, you know, that's, there's no downtime. So at that time, I would have said, no, you know, our baby girl was born, I was busy, but I was also working out about 4 hours a day, which in looking back was my way of dealing with it. I was also writing the business plan with this, which kept my mind busy. And I think that's what a lot of veterans don't have, is that it's just, for the most part, the community doesn't use the term disorder. And I think it's just, you know, it's, you want them to feel safe to come out and talk about it. So you don't want to make it this issue. You just, it's a part of it. And we did see this with Vietnam. We've seen this with every war. It was called shell-shocked during World War II. So it's just really trying to make those veterans that need help to get help more comfortable with reaching out for it.
Did the media that was with you, did you ever see what they wrote or the, video or the spots that they ran?
Mm-hmm. It did go on 60 Minutes. I'm not allowed to say what the special is, although people have probably seen it. But yes, they did write it. It was not inaccurate, but they left parts out, you know, to not sensationalize it, but they did leave parts out. There was an issue where a truck was coming towards a front gate where we were posted guard, and we fired warning shots. I was actually at the back of the compound. I was not up where this was happening. Warning shots were fired. It kept coming, which is a very widely used tactic over there of bursting through a gate and sometimes setting off an improvised explosive device, an ID, in a vehicle. It kept coming. Rules of engagement was once it passes a certain area, you open up and try to stop the vehicle. They did not shoot the occupants. They were shooting for the engine block, but 2 14-year-old boys in the back both got hit with bullets. We treated them, we medevaced them out, they were fine, and so they ran that story. What they didn't run was that the truck did have explosives in it. The boys had been handling them, and so it didn't make us look all that great, even though we were following a protocol. So it was a very, the cameramen, which were there with us for 4 months, were incredible, but obviously they don't edit the story, so that was left out.
One final question. Over here.
Hey, Bill, I think I just heard you say you were working on the business plan for Alamo while you were overseas. Is that right?
It was asked if I was working on the business plan for Alamo while overseas. I wrote the business for Alamo in 07, which was about a year after they started franchising, just with it in mind, during my first deployment, finished it on my second deployment, and then we put it all into action shortly after I got home.
Well, thanks. So as a tradition in airtime, and I will be following this tradition, it was left by Mr. Tucker, we sort of wrap it up with a top 10 rapid fire questions.
Okay.
And I have not discussed these with you, and although we don't have anyone in a briefcase bringing them in, they're just in my secret binder here. So just quick answers. First thing that comes to mind. Number one, night owl or morning person?
Morning.
Number two, Elvis or the Beatles?
Beatles.
Number three, hold your applause to the last question, please. Number three, Mac or PC?
Mac.
Number four, what one film should everyone see at least once in their life?
Godfather.
Number five, what is the film that you could watch over and over and over again?
Snatch.
Number six.
Hi, Richie. It's not as dirty as it sounds.
Number six. What is your favorite combination of ingredients on your burger?
Bacon, American cheese, because I am a patriot, and pickled onions.
Number seven. What is the one bit of advice that you'd give to the 18-year-old you?
Oh, invest in Dell. Is that cheating? And then take it out at a certain time.
Number eight, the upcoming film you're most looking forward to.
Star Wars, absolutely.
Number 9, favorite thing to do in your leisure time?
Read, actually.
And number 10, your favorite item on the Draft House menu?
Oh, the carnivore pizza is incredible. It's really good. If you're a vegetarian, don't get it.
Everyone, please join me in thanking our guests for airtime today.
Thank you very much.
Bill DiCatano. And thank you all for being here. This concludes our first airtime of season 6. This has been airtime created by the Arts Incubator of Richardson, and I've been your moderator, David Fisher, here at the Alamo Drafthouse at 100 South Central Expressway in Richardson, Texas. Airtime is underwritten by the Alamo Drafthouse and funded in part by the City of Richardson through the City of Richardson Cultural Arts Commission. We invite you to check out artsincubatorrichardson.org for future events and news. Our next airtime is on October 14th at 7 p.m., and our guest artist is Todd Fechter, the interim dean of the School of Arts, Technology, and Emerging Communication at the University of Texas at Dallas. There will be special showings that evening of student-created short films. Besides the movie after the interview from 1999, we will party like it's 1999. The film will be The Matrix. You can follow Airtime on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Air4Arts for all the latest developments. And podcasts of previous Airtime interviews are available through iTunes. So thank you all for being here. Enjoy the film, and we will see you in October. Passing it back over to Kitty.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Bill. Another round of applause for both David and Bill. David took away my last words. However, I always have a few more. So the one thing I wanted to share real quickly, two people I need to recognize who are part of the Airtime team and who we simply could not do this without their help. One is Chris Simons, who is our technology guru. He is also known as Rhodey. So when you go back sometime in the next week or so and listen to the podcast on iTunes of this particular airtime, it will be because of his magic. And we encourage you to do that. There are lots of other airtime interviews there for you to enjoy. Go listen to our history. It's very interesting. And secondly, Kathy Tran, who is our award-winning photographer. And we are so delighted to be partnering with her and have her support and her expertise. So her photographs will be showing up on that Instagram site as well as other places. So thank you all for coming. Please enjoy Ocean's 11, and we look forward to seeing you in October. Thanks.